Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Burns, a Manchester City fan. You can reach me on Twitter at Richard the Burns, and I am on the Blue Moon podcast, a dedicated Manchester City podcast.
Hi, I'm Jamie Smith. I cover Burnley FC, and I'm here to talk about Burnley.
Hi, I'm Jake, a Newcastle fan. You can get me on Twitter at JakeJack with two N's. I write for EPL Index and The Boot Room.
Terrific. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Up first, I want to talk about Manchester City, which is fortunate since we have Richard on the show today. As we sit through 11 matches, Manchester City have 4 more points than Arsenal's Invincibles did in 2003-2004. How realistic do we think it is that Manchester City could have an undefeated season?
I think there is, for as long as we remain unbeaten, we sort of have to acknowledge that it is possible. However, beyond that, I very much sort of go with Guardiola's line of thinking and with what he's saying, that it's extremely unlikely. Because there's so much that needs to come together for that to happen. So the reason that I think it's possible is because I do believe that sort of what we're seeing at the moment, City are the best team in the league by, I think at the moment, quite some distance. That might level out as the season goes on, but the way we're playing at the moment is pretty extraordinary, and sort of the extraordinary is beginning to look quite normal with some of the things that we're doing at the moment. So records tumbling week after week, whether they be club records or Premier League records. And so there is not a team at the moment that I wouldn't feel confident playing. It's strange to go to a game against Arsenal, bearing in mind our record against them, and sort of expecting beforehand to win and not feeling concerned when they get a goal back. Everything just sort of feels quite comfortable at the moment. But the Premier League is full of very, very good football teams, and it's not impossible that after the international break, we go to Leicester and lose. That it's a possibility. At some point, somebody is going to work out how to stop City. There's whether that means absolutely packing the defence and midfield and just having absolutely no attacking intention sort of at all. Someone's going to work out how to stop us scoring. And then all it takes is a breakaway goal or a bit of luck like we got today with an offside call going our way when Silva was offside for our third goal. It doesn't take that much to lose a game of football, and at some point we have to have an off day. It's unrealistic to expect that not to happen. However, there is a precedent for a really, really good team being able to go the season unbeaten, and so obviously I'd love it to happen, but I'm placing no sort of expectation on it. I don't think anybody at City really talks about it. I think it's very much something that comes from outside of the club with which is very nice, people admiring how well City are playing at the moment and acknowledging that quality. But it's not really amongst City fans. It's not the buzz around the place that we could do a season unbeaten. There is a buzz about how well we could do and about how many trophies we might win and all that stuff, because at the moment we're clearly in trophy-winning form. So on how realistic it is, the luck that we'd have to get with injuries and having sort of every game not having a major decision or a wonder goal or whatever, or just a team playing well against us. I mean, it's hard to conceive of going a full season without some of those things coming together to lead to a defeat. Football teams lose games. It has to happen at some point. So it's probably not realistic to expect. However, on any individual day, against any individual team on any given day, City can be better than anyone and can beat them.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, I think this City team is probably better on paper and man for man, better than the Arsenal's Invincibles team at the moment. But I think it's probably too early to be talking about going a whole season unbeaten. We're still in early November, and City started last season similarly well, and they've done it before and faded away. So there's a chance that that could happen again. They look unstoppable at the moment, but teams have done that and it's not happened. They've got to go to Old Trafford next month. That's obviously going to be a very, very difficult test. And freak results happen in the Premier League all the time. Burnley won at Chelsea on the opening day. Huddersfield beat Man United the other weekend. These things happen as a matter of course in the Premier League. It seems it's asking a lot for that not to happen to City at some point, and someone might just be better than them on the day as well. It doesn't have to be a sort of freak result that happens. I think also they've had luck at times. Like Richard said, they were a bit lucky at times today with the offside goal. We went to the Etihad recently. We were holding City reasonably easily until they got a penalty that was debatable, I think. So, yeah, for me, it's too early. They could do it, but there's too many variables at this stage.
Yeah, I've got some feelings on this Man City team because I always seem to come on this podcast and just give the strong opinions, which I think last time I was on, I said Koeman should definitely get sacked. I think I was the only one to say that, and that came true. So I'm not calling myself the Oracle or anything, but I'm just about to blow some smoke up Man City and probably unsettle Richard a little bit, because I think I seriously think they've got a massive chance of winning the quadruple this season. And I don't think I'm being overly dramatic and said so. I watched the game against Napoli, and I don't watch the game against Napoli and think, oh, Napoli, I've been told they're a good team by the media. This much means City must be really good to beat them twice. I've watched Napoli four or five times already this season, and I know they're a good team. And the way City played against them was incredible. Napoli sort of dominated the first 30 minutes. Then after that, City were unbelievable. And at this point, I think they're the best team I've ever seen in the Premier League in my lifetime. I was quite young when the Invincibles were about, but it wasn't the best Premier League. Like now, I think we'd all agree this is probably the strongest league that England have had, mainly because of the money and things like that. But the amount of like managerial talent playing talent we have in this league is unbelievable. And City are blowing it away. Like today, they didn't even play well. I think, Richard, would you agree? You didn't really play well today. It wasn't the best City have played at all. It's probably not even in your top five performances of the season.
Well, no, that's the thing. I absolutely agree with that. And yet we were still, by any sort of normal standard, I would class that as still a very good performance, because I thought we pretty much dominated the game. I thought City controlled it. I think there were a few signs of physical and possibly mental fatigue after the midweek game against Napoli, which was a really hard game. I thought they showed a few signs of that at times. And yeah, I'd fully agree. I think sort of in this run of wins that started back with the third game of the season when we beat Bournemouth in the last minute, I think probably only Arsenal, Napoli and Burnley are games where I thought we were in. I came away from it thinking that we'd had a real test and really have to. I mean, obviously they always have to work for the win, but where it was clear that it hadn't come maybe quite as easy as it has in some of the other high scoring wins. And yet, despite feeling like it wasn't one of our really better performances of the season, we still created a good few chances and still scored three goals, which is the frightening bit in terms of how well they're playing at the moment, that even on the bad days, things are going very, very well.
Yeah, for me, it was the final ball. I didn't think the final ball was good at all. Yeah. There was that one moment from Sterling in the first half that was an awful ball, and there was three or four other situations
like
where...
In the last 10
minutes.
Yeah,
there were three or four situations where I thought that if City were on form, they would have scored, and they still scored three goals. regardless of them, you know, not being great in the final third, which is just really scary to think about. And I think that the quality of the Premier League is probably going to stop them going unbeaten, because there, any team can beat anyone. And, you know, there's going to be tiredness, there's going to be injuries and things like that. But I do think this City team is the best team I've ever seen in my lifetime in the Premier League. And I think, as things stand in Europe as well, they're probably the favourites to win the Champions League. I think they're the team playing best in Europe. And then the other two cup competitions, like, people talk about the quadruple all the time. They always used to talk about it when Mourinho's Chelsea, Ferguson and Man United got talked about a few times. And I think this City team, if anyone's going to do it, I wouldn't be surprised if it's this City team, whether it's this season, next season or the year after. I think this City team is going to win so many trophies, and it's going to be looked back on as probably the best team we've seen in the Premier League.
Just while we're on City, Richard, I have to pick City up on this 15-game winning run thing. Like, does a draw against Wolves count as a win now? Like,
right. Now, see, I definitely see both sides of this. I'm mildly uncomfortable with it counting towards the record. However, yeah.
There has to be a winner on the night, so yeah, it can make sense. But you didn't win the game.
No, I agree they didn't win the game, but they progressed. And there is, the only thing I'd say with it, is this isn't just a City thing. There's precedent for this. So, for example, Alex Ferguson's 100th European win. That can't be. Yeah, his 100th European win, or whatever it was with United, was won on penalties. And I think there was another one where it's been counted towards a record, a team winning on penalties. And so, although I'm not completely in agreement with counting a game that was drawn in a sequence of wins, there is precedent. This isn't just City sort of belligerently trying to play.
I hope you stop winning at some point, because it's going to get more annoying as the season goes on.
Yeah, I hope we don't. To me, an asterisk record. It's like it's 14 games. However, one game was won on penalties. It'll always have that with it. But if I stop being objective and be subjective, of course it's a win. Of course it's a record.
Speaking on how good City have been, kind of agree with you, Jake. Mauricio Pochettino was asked in his press conference about Manchester City and said they are currently the best team in Europe. And there is a weird animosity between Tottenham and City right now. So it was a surprise that he was so willing to come out and say that. Was going to ask you guys who you thought had the best chance of upending City, but it kind of sounds like all of you just think it could just happen at any point and wouldn't require any particular matchups. Kind of following on with the European football note, another great week for British teams in the Champions League. United, Liverpool, City, and Tottenham all lead their groups. Chelsea still in a position to advance in second in their group. Do you care how the other Premier League teams do in the Champions League? Do you feel like it promotes the strength of the league throughout the continent, or do you not really care since it's not your club?
At the risk of just being blunt, I could hardly care less, other than sort of being very impressed by Tottenham's result, and I suppose that raising, piquing more of an interest in me, because Tottenham are a team that I get to see far more often than other teams in the Champions League, because obviously at the very least I get to see the highlights packages every week that are on. So it piques my interest, but I don't sort of sit and think, I hope the English clubs do well tonight, or have any sort of extra happiness for them. Nor do I have any animosity towards them. It's, you know, I was sort of, you know, you're impressed and you put yourself in the shoes of the fans who've got to see their team beat Real Madrid, and I guess you sort of feel a happiness for them because that's an incredible result. But beyond sort of, like I say, being a bit more interested in the English teams, I don't have any extra desire to see them win. I'll be interested to see how this goes with the other guys, to be honest, because I probably consider myself quite a selfish football fan. If it's not City or doesn't impact City, I don't really care how it goes. I'm interested in it, but just everybody else can get on with themselves and will worry about us.
Yeah, I'm not really bothered either, to be honest. I think One of the things that I do like about English teams going further in the Champions League is the level of coverage that we get is just much better. It feels like once the English teams are out or they're not doing well, the media just sort of loses interest and you don't get really good coverage of the all European ties that don't involve Premier League teams. So from that perspective, I'd like English teams to stay in. I'm not that bothered about the Champions League anyway until we qualify for it this season. Not really bothered. Doesn't affect Burnley that much anyway. And it's quite predictable, isn't it, the Champions League? Until you get into the business end, sort of March with the knockouts, quarterfinals, that sort of business. Until you get there, it's just a bit boring and rubbish anyway. It's too big. It's too overblown. Should be straight knockouts all the way through. I think it's probably as good for the league if clubs are doing well in the Champions League. You probably attract a higher class of player. I don't think it's that much of a coincidence that the players that you'd probably consider to be the best players in the world have been in La Liga in the last few years, and they've been dominant in the Champions League. Madrid have won it back-to-back. Atleti have been to the final twice in the last 4 years or whatever. And Barca obviously won it a few times before then. So I think the talent will concentrate where the titles are. Neymar going to PSG obviously changes that a little bit. And if they win it this year, then maybe it'll be balanced out a little bit. But yeah, to answer the question overall, not that fast.
Yeah, I'd take a similar stance to that. I'm not too bothered. I have a vested interest in English teams doing well purely off a selfish writing point of view, as I do a lot better there if English teams are doing well, because yeah, I get asked to write more and stuff. But apart from that, I'm not really that bothered. I just like watching football. I like watching the Champions League. I like watching the best match of the night. Like, I watched Napoli City. I didn't watch it because City and English. I just watched it because it was a really good matchup, and I just watched football for that reason. I'm not that interested. There was a point when I used to be bothered and care about the coefficient, but I think they've made that pretty closed shop for English teams. I think the Premier League got the most money. We're always going to have loads of teams in the Champions League. It's not really an issue. So if Newcastle ever get to that point, which I'm fairly hopeful of maybe one day getting into the Champions League, if all things go well with our takeover, then maybe then I will care about how English teams do a lot more. But yeah, I'm not really. I just sort of like watch it for the football. I can't care who wins as long as, you know, I'm entertained, which I often am.
Yeah, as long as football is the winner.
Great point. Yeah, and on the coefficient, it doesn't actually matter for England anymore. They now have a guaranteed four teams every year, so there's no longer that weird race with Italy where they were kind of competing with each other for 2 or 3 years. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right, and we are back. Richard, we will just continue with City Watch 2017. There's been news, kind of came out of Rummenigge at Bayern, saying that Alexis has picked his club for next year, considering how close that transfer looked in the fall. I think assumptions could be made that it could potentially be City, but now there's somewhat of a complication in that Leroy Sané has been in incredible form. As a City player, would you like to see a player like Alexis come and take one of the spots in your starting 11, or would you rather see a player like Sané or Sterling just develop into that level of talent?
I'm not sure it's an either-or situation. I think my biggest concern is not so much him taking a spot from Sterling, Sané or anybody else. My biggest concern is the risk of just unbalancing the team, of bringing a player in January who obviously hasn't played with the team before and has to get used to that. That'd be my only concern. I think there are times when the way Sanchez behaves on the pitch doesn't necessarily match with the way our players behave. I think he sometimes comes across as this is probably going to sound really unfair, but I think at times he comes across as quite selfish. You see quite often if something goes wrong, he does that sort of sitting on his knees and gesticulating with his arms, because it sort of appears that everything is everybody else's fault and never his, and he wants to actively show that he cares more than everybody else. So I would worry about that. However, he's worked with Guardiola before. Guardiola has very high standards of what he expects from his players, not only on the pitch but in a sort of personal capacity, the attitude and behaviour that he expects from them. So obviously the fact that he wants Sanchez so much suggests that there shouldn't be any concerns about his behaviour or how he'd blend into the squad. It's just that isn't typical of how City players behave at the moment. But then if he was in this City team, maybe he wouldn't have as much cause to do that and wouldn't be as frustrated as often as he is at Arsenal, where he is quite clearly a cut above everybody else there. I don't worry about him. I did in the summer worry about whether he'd take a place from Sterling or Sané. I don't worry about that now because they're both proving themselves. And the Sterling, and in particular at the moment, is undroppable. He's obviously, we have rotation, so every now and then he has to take a seat on the bench for that purpose. But his performances are incredible. He's hit a superb level of consistency. He's our top scorer for the season, which for a player who can't shoot, apparently, or has always had problems with his finishing and decision making, so it's quite a lot that he's the top scorer in this team. So there'd be no reason to take him out. What I think Sanchez would allow, rather than seeing it as stopping Sané or Sterling, I think it would allow us, and it would allow Guardiola more sort of tactical flexibility with that team. He's clearly moving Sterling central. He still obviously gets wide, but when you look at the goals that he's scoring, they are typical of Guardiola teams. From a ball out wide, Sterling is actually usually in the box rather than necessarily providing that ball, and a lot of his goals are coming from that and taking a ball in either from Sané or from one of the fullbacks who's attacking, which is exactly sort of how Guardiola's always set his teams up. He's explicitly said he sees Sterling's future as being in the centre, and so I think Sanchez complements that because he can do the lot across the front, and so he would probably facilitate Sterling moving central rather than blocking him. And Sané, again, extremely impressive. His decision making is fantastic. His finishing, his assist rate is unbelievable. So Sanchez would provide competition, but I don't think he blocks the path. I think he does just provide competition. And I thought before the season started that we look crowded in attacking positions, but everybody's getting a chance. And we're benefiting from it. And it keeps everybody to an incredibly high standard. So I don't have any concerns on the playing front. I just worry about, is January the best time to make a change to what is an incredibly well-functioning unit at the moment? But then on the flip side of it, we've only got two out-and-out strikers in Aguero and Jesus. If one of them gets injured for even a month with the amount of games that we play because we're still in all competitions, then you suddenly put a hell of a lot of pressure on one of those strikers, and that requires Guardiola to come up with a few different ideas, because he wouldn't reasonably expect one of them to be playing 7 to 8 games in a month without a break, I don't think. So Sanchez could help ease that, and I suspect that if and when he comes in, we'll probably quickly wonder why we ever wondered how he would fit in.
It's interesting that you said pathway there, Richard, because it certainly adds to the options, but taking a more medium-term view, what would signing Sanchez mean for someone like Phil Foden, who was so brilliant at the Under-17 World Cup? Everyone seems to think he's the next best thing, but how's he going to get a chance at City if he's signing more forwards?
That's a really good question. Youngster, I mean, the kids have a very, very difficult path at City anyway. When you're able to attract top-class players, it's always going to make it harder to get those youngsters into the team. There's been a lot of very highly rated players that have that have got fed up or that have seen their path is blocked. Jadon Sancho moving in the summer to Dortmund is the obvious example of that. One that we will probably regret in years to come and see it as being very clumsily handled. It's really hard, I think, when you want to win every competition you're in, to put the trust in the kids who are inexperienced. I can see why the route is so often to loan them out, but then they don't break in because we've typically signed players in the meantime. I don't really have an answer to that. This is something that comes up again and again and again between City fans. There are those who are desperate to see academy products in the team, those who don't really care so much about that side of it. Foden is probably a particularly special case because he's a very local lad. City fan, born and bred and everything, and people always tend to have a sort of special fondness for those players, and it's something that we've not had at City for a long time. So how he gets in, I don't know. I guess the two Champions League games coming up where we already know that we're through, I'd imagine you'll get a chance in at least one of those, particularly if we've already guaranteed top spot by the time we play Shakhtar, because the Shakhtar game in December falls just before the derby. So he's going to be desperate to rest players for that, I think. And that will be an in for him. What is noticeable about Foden is that Guardiola, right from pre-season, has been speaking about how he will get his chance in the first team. So it's not like he's been shy about building this lad up. I think after the friendly against United, Guardiola said that he hadn't seen anything so special for years and told all the journalists that were sort of there that they should feel very privileged to have witnessed the start of something special. So he clearly has very high hopes for Foden, and we've seen him develop youngsters very well before Guardiola and fit sort of young players into very good teams. But how, like, I don't see a clear path for it. It's a very fair question and one that I'd love to have an answer to. But I don't. It's really hard to see how the kids get a chance.
But right now, he's only 17. Like, it's mad to think he should be given first team football. That's incredibly young.
But the best 17 year olds in Spain get games, the best 17 year olds in Germany get games. It's one of the reasons that England's senior team isn't very good. Is because when these kids are very highly rated, they just don't get first team football. And I think it's no coincidence that England's two best players at the moment, probably Harry Kane, Dele Alli, went out on loan. Kane went out on loan. Dele Alli played a lot of games as a kid in League One with MK Dons. So someone like Phil Foden, I think you just have to take a stand at some point and say, this kid's brilliant, we're going to have to play him.
I think it's too. Mbappe broke through last season at 18, and that was it. And he's an incredibly gifted talent. He broke through at 18. I think 17 is very young, and I think I've seen some calls from professional footballers saying that these under 17 players should be given Premier League experience now. And I've even seen one claim that some of them should go to the World Cup this summer, which is absolutely ridiculous. I think it's all about measuring expectations. They're very young. They've got a lot of development to go through. And I think he could learn a lot on the training ground as opposed to just being thrown into Premier League football where he could just get his career destroyed so quickly. When I've seen him for the under 17s, I think he's good. But when you've got De Bruyne, Silva, Sterling, Sané, he's nowhere near that level. And it would be crazy to throw him in.
Yeah, I agree with that on Foden. I guess I was in answering the question, probably taking the point just as general, how do youth players get into the City team? And that's the bit that is really hard. I agree I wouldn't be throwing him into league games just yet. Probably for a couple of years, really. But at some point, there has to come the chance to put him in. And at whatever age they decide to do that, whether they wait until he's 20 or 21 before he starts getting regular chances, there's still going to be very good players in front of him. So at whatever point it comes, there still has to be a leap of faith because he's only going to get experience one way, and that's playing him. So I agree, I'm not concerned about it now, but just sort of extrapolating the point to any youth player that wants to get through at City. It's balancing that need to give them that need for them to prove that they are worthy of playing. I've lost my train of thought here. But balancing that need to prove that they're worthy of playing against how you actually give them the chance to do that, I guess. It's a really difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how all those U17 players are brought through. And there was actually a really interesting discussion on our championship show about what's the responsibility level for clubs to get those players to regular football and then the international stage. And I think it's just kind of a process. And I think it varies for a lot of different players. And I think if there was one clear way to do it, you would do it all the time. I do agree with Jamie that having players get their football younger, like specifically for the U.S., Pulisic at Dortmund is obviously, that's huge for his development. But you also have players that crumble under that pressure, as Jake said. So I just think it's a balance. And if there was a right answer, everybody would do it one way. Coming to you now, Jamie, probably too late in the show to talk about this, but Burnley are currently level with Chelsea, Liverpool, and Arsenal in the Premier League table, have been playing some solid football this year, but now seems like something could come and derail that, which is potentially Dyche leaving for Everton. Do you think the story should be more what you've done thus far or what could happen if Dyche does leave?
I think it's understandable, isn't it? I mean, Burnley's success is built very much on a solid defence and organised systems, and it's not very interesting to talk about. So the media has to find a new route into talking about how Burnley are doing well, and that inevitably means that the manager gets linked with other jobs. In terms of losing Dash, I think the timing now is probably as good as it's going to be. There's been a lot of talk about Dash and what his next step's going to be, especially in the summer when he was linked very strongly with Crystal Palace and they went with De Boer instead, and look how well that worked out. So I think it's always been difficult to see what his next step is. If Everton offer him the job, I don't think it's a big decision to make, to be honest. We're seventh in the league now, fair enough, but Everton finished there last season. They started badly, but you'd back them to probably finish in the top half again and be pushing to break into that sort of top six, big six clubs. So I think he would have to go. How we cope with that, obviously a lot of Burnley fans are concerned because the last time we lost the manager in the middle of the season when we're in the Premier League, we appointed Brian Laws. I think as long as we don't do that again, it's going to be better. But yeah, I mean, we've got 19 points on the board already. We're halfway to safety. It's November. So we're a very attractive proposition, I think. Last time the job came up in the Premier League, when we appointed Brian Laws. I'm going to keep saying that because can you believe Brian Laws got a job in the Premier League? I still can't. It was 7 years ago or whatever. But Andre Villas-Boas was among the applicants that time. Before he was in charge of Chelsea and Spurs and various other clubs around Europe. So a lot of highly rated young coaches will be interested in that job, as well as obviously the names like Allardyce and Moyes, who would probably get linked with it. So I think in terms of attracting a good quality manager to then take the club on, I think we're in a good position. Some fans, fair enough, would like him to stay until the end of the season. There's a lot of talk about seeing the job through. I don't know exactly what that means. When you're in charge of a football club, the job is never really done. Even when you win loads of trophies, the challenge is always to then do it again. So there's never going to be a really clean break. For me, getting Burnley into the Premier League and then keeping us in the Premier League, that was the job done for me. In terms of taking Burnley on to the next level, it's hard to see what the next level would be for a club like Burnley. Even sort of middly clubs like Stoke and West Brom, it's a case of swimming against the tide every year, just trying to tread water, and survival still the ultimate goal. So I think if that's the level we're aspiring to be, a Stoke or a West Brom, you can see why Dyche will be interested by going to Everton, who probably have that more room for growth. They're going to move into a new stadium. They'll genuinely think they could be contenders for the Champions League every season, and fair play to them. So I think it's a difficult situation for the club in that they'll have known that this was always a chance. Ultimately, if your manager's getting linked with bigger clubs, it means that you're doing well, so you can't begrudge them too much. I think how he handles it is going to be important in how he is then seen by supporters. when Owen Coyle left and was replaced by Brian Laws, remember when Brian Laws got a Premier League job? It was very badly done. He basically disappeared up to Scotland, didn't do a press conference after a match, just disappeared, and just sort of walked out and left everyone feeling a bit shell-shocked, took half his backroom staff with him, and really the heart and soul of the club sort of went with Owen Coyle, and it took us a long time to rebuild after that. I think Dyche is a much more straightforward bloke. He'll try and do it in the best way that doesn't harm the club. I don't think he's really going to come in and try and buy all our players, probably because they're not good enough for Everton anyway. So, I think it's a good opportunity for him. Everton's a massive club, potential to be absolutely huge with all the money that they've got at the moment. Everton fans seem a bit upset that only Sean Dyche is going to get the job rather than an Ancelotti or a Thomas Tuchel or whatever, but... For me, it's about time that someone like Dyche got the opportunity to manage at a club like Everton. And if he does go, and it sounds like it might happen in the next couple of days, all the best to him. And I won't panic too much about what happens next at the club, because we're seventh in the Premier League. Like, why be worried?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely reason for you to be.
Yeah, I mean,
pretty like, comfortable. You're almost halfway to safety
from where we are now. Like. Yeah, we could get relegated, but it would be extraordinary to get relegated from where we are now. We would have to be absolutely atrocious. I'm not too concerned. I think actually how far up the league we are and how many points we've got, it means that we can be a bit more left field in our thinking rather than be like, oh, panic, give the job to Allardyce, we'll stay up. I think we can be a bit riskier, maybe look abroad, someone who hasn't worked in the Premier League, someone who hasn't even worked in English football. Just think outside the box a little bit and just be a bit risky, because we're probably going to stay up anyway.
Yeah. 19 points already is definitely a benefit after just playing 11 matches. Hopefully it turns out well. As you say, it does sound like Dyche will be leaving, but it will definitely be interesting to see who comes in and takes that job. And if they maintain the style that you currently play, are you expecting that in a potential appointee, or do you think you'd be more willing to just roll with whatever system a new manager could bring?
I think you've got to work with what's there, and Dyche has signed players that fit into what he wants to do. He's also convinced players who maybe didn't quite fit that to then do that job. Players like Stephen Defoe, who sort of thought might leave in the summer. He wasn't happy with his game time. He wasn't happy with doing so much running around without the ball. Defoe this season has totally bought into it. He's a completely different player this season, playing in a different sort of role, and it's paid off handsomely for him and for the club. So I think it would have to be someone who's going to play probably a similar style. I don't think anyone's going to come to Burnley and try and play like tiki-taka football, like do what De Boer did at Palace and just try and totally change the identity and the style and everything that everyone recognises about the club. I don't think that would be realistic. So for that reason, if we're going to talk about names, it feels a bit like talking about who you want to be your next girlfriend before your wife's divorced you. But maybe someone like Michael O'Neill, Northern Ireland manager, done very well on no resources, really. Gets the best out of his players. They run through brick walls for him every single game. That's what we need from a manager. So, yeah, obviously, depending on the World Cup playoffs, he wouldn't leave if they qualify. But I think Michael O'Neill, someone of that sort of profile, would probably be a good fit.
Cool. We'll definitely keep an eye on that. Jake, we haven't had you on since all of this Newcastle takeover stuff has happened. Obviously, Mike Ashley been there for quite some time for to mixed results and reactions from the Newcastle faithful. How likely does it look like the buyout will go through? And secondly, what do we think the club would look like after it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and a difficult one for me to answer anyway. I don't have any sort of information on this, but I'll just go from what I've read and sort of the vibes I'm getting from people that I sort of trust on these things. I think your takeovers aren't a lot of fun. They're not like transfers. They take ages. So every day I log into Twitter and I see Newcastle fans saying, oh, what? I hope is there any takeover news, asking journalists and stuff. It's not going to come out overnight. Like, these things take ages. And they talk about... my Christmas. Of course he does, because he doesn't want to spend any money in January. That is, of course, what he wants to do. But I think there's hopeful vibes it's going to go through before Christmas. And if not, I think it's going to go through before the end of the season. I don't think this time in the summer, or you know, this time next year, or even in the summer, I don't think Mike Ashley will be owner of Newcastle, and I'm going to be very happy about that. I've seen a lot of people saying it could be a lot worse than Mike Ashley. Maybe better the devil you know. Yeah, they said that with Pardew, and we got Benitez. Like, Newcastle is a club of huge potential. I'm not trying to be sort of arrogant or maybe a bit deluded, but Newcastle are a huge club, and what Mike Ashley's managed it very sort of owned it very poorly. I think we've got a lot worse over his tenure. When he bought the club, we were a similar level to Tottenham. Look where they are, look where we are. Yeah, it's not much of a competition. Like, we've gone backwards. He's got 2 relegations on his CV. He's sold land around the ground that we could have built on, that now looks unlikely. It's now a student accommodation, so building on St. James's Park looks unlikely, which is annoying. I just think it's the right time for him to leave. Like, I think the reason he wants to sell is because the money's got a bit too crazy in the Premier League. He thought he could manage it and make a profit and hope to stay in the Premier League. Now he has no interest in paying more than $10 million for a player, and he can't do that in the Premier League. We'd only go down, so it's the right time. And I think the group that are probably going to buy it, I think it's Amanda Staveley. I think she has a investment group there, talks of Liverpool. She was involved in the Man City buyout. She's sort of got a lot of links in the Middle East. I'm not sure if she's backing it herself, but she seems to be the front woman. They were willing to pay $1 billion for Liverpool, so $400 million for Newcastle, and you put the rest on players, we'd probably have, you know, a very good squad. So I think it's really hopeful. If you can't be excited at a time like this, when can you be excited? It could go bad, but I'm quite optimistic. I think we've got Benitez, we've got a very good manager, we've got a good stadium, a good fan base. The potential at Newcastle is huge. I think anyone on any one of you would agree, if there was any club right now to buy in the Premier League, if you wanted to go and build and become a top six team, Newcastle are the most obvious example to do that. I think most things are in place, and if you just invested a bit, showed a bit of ambition, we could get there. So I can see why there's a lot of interest, and hopefully it'll go through before Christmas and we could buy some players. But if not, I'm happy to wait the end of the season and stay in the Premier League and then hopefully build on from there.
I mean, first of all, it looks like you will be fine, as you say, but a striker would be very appreciated at this time based on the fact that Joselu does not like to put the ball in the back of the net. Perhaps harsh, but the finishing not really high level there. Regardless of the ownership situation, do you think you'd address that position in January?
I'd hope so, but I don't think we would if Mike Ashley was still here. I don't think we'll buy anybody. I think he's got a very excuse not to do any transfer business now. So, yeah, I think we've probably got a good enough squad to stay up as it is. A striker would have been good. I think if Rafa Benitez would have been backed in the summer, we'd probably be in a similar position to what Burnley are now. I think we've lost. There's 4 games that we've lost. Huddersfield, Brighton, Burnley and Bournemouth. And after each defeat, I've seen a lot of fans complaining that, oh, this is a game we could regret. This is these are teams that we should be beating, which is just incredibly arrogant. Like, who are we to think we should be beating these teams? We are a newly promoted team. These teams also probably look at Newcastle as a game they could win, and they all did. But we lost every game by 1-0, which is annoying because it's so tight. But that's sort of the game plan we've got. We're going to go and try and be tight, try and keep a clean sheet, try and keep things tight, and then try and nick one on the break. And we're doing fine with that, I think. You know, the crazy thing about all these games is, like, people say, oh, we could regret them because we didn't win them. If we'd have won all 4 of those games, we'd be in second position. Like, that's mental. We're not that good. We are pretty much where we should be, I think. The last week's been a bit of a blow, you know, 2 losses. It's tough to take, and there's a lot of people, a lot thinking now, oh, we're going to start slipping down the league. We're in a false position. We beat Palace, Swansea and West Ham. We're not very good. But, you know, the Premier League's not that simple. It's a long-term process. You don't make short-term decisions. Like, each game is very short-term. Like, you look at the longer process, we're doing fine. We've got a good squad. We've got a good manager. We've got, you know, we're progressing, we're competing well. I've seen watching Newcastle under McLaren, I've watched them under Pardew. We got blown away 3 or 4 nil regularly. That's not happened once this season. Even against Tottenham, when we had 10 men for half of the game, we only lost 2-0. And I think that was probably one of Tottenham's lowest away victories in a while. You were winning quite a few on the road, like 3 or 4 nil at that point in a row. And we had 10 men and managed to keep it down to 2-0. We're going to be fine. We're going to be in games. We're going to be competing well. I think, we don't have great strikers. I think Dwight Gayle scored, he got a goal at the weekend, which probably should have been given. But I can see why it wasn't. It was an offside call when the linesman was looking across. He couldn't see the guy that was keeping him onside on the opposite side of the pitch. If it would have happened, if he was on the offside of the pitch, the linesman, it would have been given and we probably would have won the game. So we're not good enough to have those decisions go against us. At this point, we need those decisions to go for us, and they're not. So, yeah, we lost the game. It happens. On the strikers, I think we've got Mitrovic, who hasn't played in a while. He didn't come on at the weekend, which a lot of fans were annoyed about. But I think there's players like this at every club that, when they're not in the team, fans think they're a lot better than they actually are. Like, they managed to, become better because they're not in the team. Like, I've seen Mitrovic play. He's a good player. I'd love to see him get given a go because Josselu's not working, but he's not like an incredible striker. It's not like Benitez is keeping like an incredible striker on the bench. He's an absolute liability, and that's why he's not in the team. We're a newly promoted club. We've got we're level on goal difference. I think we got 10 goals conceded. We're in 11th position. We're doing absolutely fine.
Yeah, now we will move on to Player Watch. We're going to talk about the player that you feel is most underappreciated at your club, either internally, where the fans don't seem to recognize the talent, or externally, where you think maybe the media aren't covering just how good a player is at your club. We'll lead in with you, Richard.
This is really hard because it seems like everybody's quite well appreciated at the moment, but at City. I guess I would... There's probably two. One of them... is playing fast and loose, I guess, with the question. I think I could argue Kyle Walker, for all the plaudits he gets and how everybody sees the difference that he's made to the team and what having a properly attacking fullback does, and one who's fast and can still get up the line. Everybody's seen what that has done for City. But I think he is judged probably fairly, I guess, but he's judged against his price tag, which was particularly high, and made him the most expensive defender in the world at the time before we then went and bought Mendy a few weeks later. £50 million for a right back is something we hadn't seen before. It's a, for want of a better way of putting it, it's an unsexy position. And so he probably doesn't win the plaudits he deserves outside of the club because there's that price tag puts such a high expectation on him. But he is as important, that position is as important to City as all of our attacking positions because the fullbacks allow everything else to happen. It dictates where the midfielders sit, it dictates what the chance creation for the strikers. It's so important to the way that we use space and the way that Guardiola positions his players that Walker has been absolutely instrumental. And the fact that we've got Danilo, who, when we've seen him, has been good. He's a perfectly capable right-back, and we spent £25 million quid on him. Can't get a look in at the moment. And that will change. I mean, he did play against Napoli, so he's obviously going to be trusted in big games. But Walker is so good at the moment that it's very, very hard to get Danilo in, who fits the bill for what we need, but is... Walker's just on a really, really high level. The other one that definitely doesn't get plaudits is Otamendi. He still suffers. I think we spoke before, Kev, about how sort of narrative cycles don't really change as quickly as they should. So once people have made the mind up on a player, that sticks even though the player might improve. Otamendi has really, really improved under Guardiola. He still has the occasional rash moment in him. I think our win at Chelsea, he nearly cost us a game by diving in with a really stupid tackle on the touchline, giving away a free kick where we were under no danger. Straight away in stoppage time and 1-0 up gives Chelsea a dead ball. close to the box. So he does still have a rash moment in him, but the vast majority of the time what we're seeing is that he's learned to basically defend on his feet rather than on his backside. Is that the rashness is it is being taken out of his game. He is clearly put in a lot of work, because that diving in, that charging forward was his natural game, and he has had to tame his own instincts, tame the way that he plays. It's not like he's just like he had a foundation to work on and he's improved on it. He has changed the way that he defends. On the ball, he's very, very good. And so all the stuff that we're seeing with Stones, we keep seeing these stats about how Stones has got the best pass accuracy of any player in Europe's top five leagues and all this stuff. Because he's doing so well and making good on what everybody saw was, or what most people saw was really good potential, he's now reaching that. I think the guy next to him is going massively underappreciated. And the test, I think, is ask any City fan at the moment, would a fit Vincent Kompany walk back into this team? And the honest answer has to be no. And I can't think of a higher compliment you can pay a central defender at City than saying our sort of talismanic captain, who we spent years not being able to play without, will now struggle to get back into the team, even if you sort of assume perfect fitness. So I think Otamendi deserves a lot of credit. And he's even weighing in with a couple of goals. So he's doing everything at the moment. And he's had to overcome being a bit of a scapegoat to do that. So I think it's really nice to see. Mm.
Jamie, at Burnley, who do you feel doesn't get the plaudits they deserve?
Yes, yeah, similar to Richard, really. It's always difficult to talk about players at Burnley because it's so much about the collective and everyone plays for each other so much that individuals don't often shine that much. I could talk about Nick Pope, who's been absolutely fantastic since coming in to replace Tom Heaton. People have been terrified that we might lose Tom Heaton for the last couple of seasons. Like, what happens if Heaton goes, well, Heaton's got injured and it's been fine because Nick Pope's the best young goalkeeper in the Premier League. So it's made absolutely no difference. I think he's kept clean sheets in more than half of his games. He's got the best save percentage in the Premier League at the moment. He's been outstanding. To the extent that some Burnley fans have even suggested he should be in the England squad, not the team, already, even though he's essentially still a child in goalkeeping terms. But it's actually Jack Cork that I want to pick out. When we signed Jack Cork in the summer, people were happy to see him back. He'd had a couple of loan spells when he was younger and done well. But it wasn't seen as the sort of signing that was really going to take us on to the next level. I remember seeing Swansea fans being thrilled to have got £10 million for Jack Cork. This is a player with a lot of appearances in the Premier League who had done a fine job for Swansea, and they're terrible without him. So look how that works out. But he's been an absolute revelation. Last season we had Joey Barton playing in midfield a lot of the time, and Barton's positioning was excellent, and the way he read the game was really good. But in terms of covering the ground, it was a real area where we struggled a little bit sometimes in just getting around the pitch and up the pitch when we were trying to counter and things like that. It just held us back a bit that Barton was so old and so slow. Jack Cork's had a real dynamism to the Burnley midfield. Before this weekend's Premier League games, he'd covered more ground than any player in the league. Obviously, there's more to football than running, but it's no secret that it's a massive part of the way Burnley play the game, that we run harder than every other team. We cover more ground than every other team. And Jack Cork's addition has just allowed us to do that. I don't think it's a coincidence at all that our away form has been transformed with having a player like Cork that can help with the transitions a lot faster. He helps us get up the pitch. He covers the ground. He closes teams down. And he's just made such a big difference. People talk about Nick Pope for England. Jack Cork for England seems like a bit of a no-brainer to me. Jake Livermore was getting in the squad until recently. Jake Livermore's not a good player. Jack Cork's got as much Premier League experience as Livermore. He started the season absolutely brilliantly. It just seems to me with England that if you haven't played for Southgate in the under-21s, like Loftus-Cheek, for example, he's done absolutely nothing to earn a senior call-up. You just don't get a look at the moment. I don't know what more Jack Cork could be doing at Burnley to be getting that recognition at international level. It seems extraordinary. I'm getting on my soapbox now, but it seems extraordinary to me that Burnley can be as good a team as Arsenal, as good as Liverpool, as good as these teams, yet none of our players are in the England squad, and most of our players are English. It just seems insane to me. Like, how can that tally up? So for me, Jack Cork's the obvious outstanding player compared to what we had last season. I think he's made a huge difference. And from our perspective, I suppose the longer that he goes unheralded, the better. And it can continue to operate under the radar. That's how Burnley have always done best.
Yeah, I'm pretty similar to Jamie. We have a team more than individuals. That's what Benitez is. The one I think is really underrated by our own fans, I'll talk about him and then move on to one that's probably underrated within sort of the nation. The first one within our own fans is Paul Dummett. He got injured in the first game against Tottenham. He's not played since, but we've missed him so much. I think having a left-footed left-back is so much better than not having one. And when you don't have one, you only realise the value of having one. Like, we've been playing Chancellor and Bemba there for a little bit. We played Kieran Clark there, and we've played Javi Mankiw there recently. I think Clark's left-footed beats a centre-back. But yeah, it's just leaves the team unbalanced, especially going forward. When Mankiw goes forward, he's just always looking to cut back in, and it stunts any progress we made, and it often leads to us going back to our centre-back. It's just not great to watch. And I think Paul Dummett, it's been much maligned with the Newcastle fans. He might be a Geordie. He might have come through the academy, but a lot of people don't rate him. But I think he's an absolutely fine full-back. Where we got relegated, there was Premier League interest in him. I think West Brom and Burnley wanted him. I think from what I've heard from people inside, well, journalists linked to the club, there was a lot of Premier League interest in Paul Dummett, and I'm not surprised. He's a very good player. He knows his own limits, a good defender, good in the air, which is always good for a fullback. And yeah, I just think we've missed him. I wouldn't have thought I'd be saying that at this point of the season, that I've missed Paul Dummett, but I definitely have, and I'm excited for him to get back in the team, because I think we're just better with him in it than without him. And probably the player that is a little bit underrated within the, maybe not the national media, I think he's pretty rated, but the maybe supporters of other clubs who pigeonhole him as a bit of an idiot, which he is, but he's also a very, very good player, and that's Jonjo Shelvey. I don't think there's a better passer of the ball that is English, and I don't even think I'm being biased in saying that. When you watch him play football, he's always, every time he plays a pass, he gives the player receiving an extra second to do something with it, and that is just such a good skill to have, and he does it with such a consistency that it's mad that he's not even talked about for England. I know Jack Cork has done very well this season. He should be in, talked about as well. There's a lot of players that are just overlooked at smaller clubs, but Jonjo Shelvey's played for England. The international game is quite slow, and I think it would suit him. He'd get time on the ball to pick passes, and he is incredible at doing that. He's just so good to watch when he's on form. And over the last year, he sort of added consistency to his performances, which has been really pleasing. And although he had a few silly moments, like the one on the first day of the season, that is, I guess, the punishment we have for having him. I think on pure talent, he's a lot better than us. He's probably, he's better than where we are currently. He's probably a top eight player, maybe even a squad player for a top six team based on pure talent, but he doesn't have the look. He looks like a complete anarchist for a want of a better word there, but yeah, he just doesn't have a great look, and he doesn't carry himself well, but he's a very, very good player. And I think he's probably known for the bad parts of his game, but he's, for what he's good at, he's very good at, and he should probably be rated a little higher.
All right, well, that will do it for us today. So if you'd like to tell the folks where they can find you or any projects you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Richard the Burns. I'm on the Blue Moon podcast, which is a Manchester City podcast released every Friday. And I write two articles a week for Yahoo Sport UK, both about City.
Hi, I've been Jamie Smith. I cover Burnley for various places. You can follow me on Twitter at Jamie Smith with two Fs.
Yeah, you can get my Twitter at JigJappin with two Ns. I work for EPL Index and The Boot Room, among various other sites, and which I will plug all of my Twitter feed. So, yeah.
And I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find my writings on fantasy football over at goal.com under the gaming tab. All right, thanks so much for joining us, guys. It's been a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.